welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Winter of the World is the second book in Ken Follett's Century Trilogy, which tracks the intertwined fates of five families from the early 1930s and the rise of Nazism through the late 1940s and the dawn of the nuclear arms race. In the novel, we follow the characters from Book One, Fall of Giants. Calvin Follett burst into the book world with Eye of the Needle, an award-winning and international bestseller. His other works include The Pillars of the Earth and its sequel, World Without End. Follett's latest project is the historical epic The Century Trilogy, and again, Book Two, Winter of the World, is now out. It's a great pleasure to welcome Ken Follett to this week's book show. Thank you very much for taking the time and being with us.
It's a pleasure to be on the show.
I remember speaking to you right after the last... World Without End, when that book came out. And you were looking to recapture some of that scope and that size. So what was it about this trilogy that drew you, a massive project like this?
I guess I was looking for a period of history to write about that would thrill me the way the Middle Ages thrills me. And I thought of the 20th century because... it's the most dramatic century in the history of the human race. We had the biggest and the worst wars ever in human history in the 20th century. More people fought, more people were killed, more people were bombed. We had the atom bomb. We had worldwide revolution. So it's a tremendously dramatic century, and... it's the century when I was born and most of my readers were born. So it's not just a terrific drama. It's also the story of where I and my readers came from.
I want to get into that a little bit in a moment. But obviously, when you commit to something like this and something this massive, you're going to be stuck with this core for thousands and thousands of pages. So in those early stages, what brought you to these five families that you write about from America, Russia, Germany, England, Wales?
Well, you're right that it's a big project. I have a 7-year timetable, and it'll be about 1 million words by the time it's finished. But I needed, of course, to tell the history of the 20th century through a group of characters who would intrigue and fascinate readers and who I would like and the readers would like, characters who we can get involved in, because I'm a novelist and this is what I do. I'm not a history book writer. So I was looking for characters, trying to invent characters who could plausibly take part in some of the great cataclysmic events of the 20th century. And so I thought, clearly there has to be a Russian family in this. Can't tell the story of the 20th century without telling the story of the Russian Revolution and communism's rise and fall. Clearly there has to be at least one American family. And so on. There's a German family, because Germany is at the center of all the conflicts of the 20th century. So that's how it worked. I thought of the history, and then I tried to think of people and their families who would be deeply involved in that history.
And you knew you wanted those families to be interconnected, that you wanted a bond that brought those families together.
Yes. I didn't want to write, as it were, five parallel stories about five disconnected families who simply lived through history. I wanted them to meet, intermarry. And so what happens in the trilogy, as in fact happened in real life, is that people often move from one country to another. So the Russians, some of the Russians come to the United States, some of the Americans go to London. In Winter of the World, people of several nationalities go to Spain during the Spanish Civil War and meet there. And so they're all intertwined in a complicated way that I hope readers find quite satisfying.
And here we are at Book Two, and when you think of this time period, the Great Depression, World War II, as the title suggests, this really is the winter of the world, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Fascism dominated most of Europe for several years. Russia and countries around Russia were part of the Soviet Union, which was communist, and... As I researched Winter of the World, I became much more of a I became more of an anti-communist than I was at the start. As I learned more and more about what happened in the Soviet Union during that period, I was shocked and horrified, actually. And I would now put communism on a par with Nazism in its brutality and mass murder, something that I didn't fully realize before I started this project. So it's the winter of the world because those two enormous areas of the world were dominated by cruel tyrannies for such a long time. And there has never been such mass murder as there was in the 20th century under the Nazis, under the communists in the Soviet Union, in Spain under Franco. It's never happened before. This kind of thing has never happened in the history of the human race. So yes, it's the winter of the world, but of course, in telling this story, I find people who live through this and rise above it, because I think that's the real story of the human race, is how we overcome this kind of awful calamity. We somehow, a few of us, always manage to rise above it and live through it.
Give us a sense of how you wanted to look at the politics of that era, because I would think that working on the first part of this project and your thoughts and your research would ultimately dictate and color how you look at this period in history.
Well, I think every author has a point of view on this kind of thing. Every author has some political point of view. But the trick is not to let your own prejudices get in the way of reality. Because what an author does, the author says to the reader, look at this with me, and I'll help you imagine it. I hate the kind of story where the author has a message. And, you know, at some point in the narrative, a wise old man says to a younger man, you know, son, in life, what you have to remember. And I think, oh, stop. Please. Stop with the author's message. So what I've tried to do is to show many points of view. Quite often in Winter of the World and Fall of Giants, two people will have an argument about politics. They'll have different points of view. And they'll have the argument, but I will leave it unresolved, because anyway, arguments never get resolved, do they, in real life? Plus, I don't want to tell readers what to think. I'm not smarter than my readers. I'm more imaginative, but I'm not smarter. I'm not wiser. So I can't say to them, this is what you should think about this issue. Instead, I say to them, look at this with me and make up your own mind.
Ken Follett is our guest on this week's book show. The new book is Winter of the World, published by Dutton. Give me an idea of time management in such a project. You mentioned that this is a 7-year time frame that you've given yourself. And I ask because there is such research, there is such outlining, but you also, like some writers, don't want the audience to wait 9-10 years between volumes.
You're absolutely right. I gave myself 3 years for the first book, Fall of Giants, because during that time I also had to block out the entire trilogy. But I was determined not to leave it another 3 years. And so I've written Winter of the World in 2 years. It is quite difficult. It's a long book, and you quite rightly say that there's a great deal of research because I like to get the history exact. I don't want there to be any mistakes in the historical background. And the only way to do that is to work 10 hours a day and 6 days a week, and that's what I do. When I finish the trilogy, I'm looking forward to a little rest.
But you start a project like this knowing that there is some security in the fact that you're going to be working on something for a long time.
Well, yes, and that is, there is something deeply satisfying about that as well. You can, in books like The Pillars of the Earth and World Without End, I was able to tell the whole life story of the principal characters. In a normal shorter novel, it's like a snapshot of the principal characters in the middle of their lives, usually at a time of great crisis. But you see them through a few days or weeks or maybe a year or two. In a long book, you see their entire biography. And now, of course, in the Century Trilogy, I'm telling a multi-generational story. And although it's more difficult, it is very satisfying if it's done well, because you see not only how somebody's life turns out, but how his kids turn out, and their kids. And as a reader, I love that kind of thing. So that's what I wanted to do for my readers.
What do you think there is about the act of picking up a book that is this hefty and just becoming completely immersed for days, maybe weeks, doubtful, but to become completely enrobed in it, and then knowing there's another one down the pike?
Well, as a reader, for me, this has always been magic, getting lost in a book. And I think that's what most of us love about literature, the fact that we start to read, we become involved in these people and in their lives, and we can't wait to see what happens next. And that, I think, is that's the secret of literature. Because, of course, you know, don't you, when you're reading, that this didn't really happen, that Follett's making this up as he goes along. And yet, we react to what happens in a novel as if it was real. Tears come to our eyes, our heart beats faster, our pulses race, we laugh, we sometimes become angry at an injustice that's going on in a novel. Why do we become angry? It's a novel. It didn't really happen. But we do. And that's the magic of literature. That's what we enjoy about it, that getting lost that you mentioned, you described so well, getting lost in the story. And if you want to write popular books, that's what you have to do to people. And, of course, the good thing about a long book is you read 50 pages and you're thinking, this is great. And, boy, I've got another 1,000 pages to go. Isn't that great?
I was thinking about this. You touched on this earlier, but I was thinking about this while reading the new book, that you're starting to come into our memory banks now in this particular volume. I assume there is a latitude when writing about medieval times or even the Russian Revolution that seizes a bit when writing about more modern history. Some readers live through this, or like me, are one generation removed. Does that change anything in the structure of the writing and even of the research?
Yes. As I get closer to the present day in the Century Trilogy, I have to be more and more careful. There are more constraints on what I can make up because of exactly what you mentioned. There will be some readers who will say, I lived through that. I was there. I remember that. And so... I have to be very careful. I'm always careful about this, but in the Middle Ages, if I make a slip, nobody remembers it. If I make a slip about, let's say, in Winter of the World, what happened at Pearl Harbor in December 1941, if I make a slip about that, there will be people who know because they were there or because their father was there. And so you're right, I do have to be more careful, but I don't mind that. I don't mind that. I mean, being careful about this sort of thing is part of the way I work, because I want to say to even readers who don't know anything about it, I want to be able to say to them, you can trust me on the history.
Do you want to have the reader see the parallels from history and today, or do you want to avoid that? Because we can certainly draw an awful lot of parallels. Certainly, looking at down the line of the next book that you're writing. So is that something you want to stay away from, or do you don't mind setting that up?
I want the reader to see parallels and to draw comparisons for himself or herself. I don't want to do it for them. I want to say this is how it was. And if they notice parallels, and if they learn lessons from history, that's great, but they must do it, because I don't want to wag my finger at the reader and say, now notice this, because I don't think that's what literature does. I don't think that's what novels do. I don't think a historical novel should explicitly draw parallels with the present day. Of course, we see history through the eyes of the present day. That's inevitable. And the more history people know, the more wisdom they will have when they think about current events. All of that's true. But then I draw the line at actually saying, in my books, notice this parallel, learn that lesson. I think that's going too far for a novelist.
In reading the book, you seem to be a fan of FDR, certainly.
Yes, I certainly am. I come at, I don't think there's any secret about my political leanings. I come from what Americans would call a liberal perspective. In Europe, we'd say a social democratic perspective. And so I see FDR as a president who intervened decisively in the economy at a moment when it was really necessary and saved the United States and the world from a much worse depression than the one we actually had. The one we had was bad enough, but it could have been much worse. So yeah, I see FDR as in that way a great president. He also walked a tightrope, didn't he? Because he didn't want to take Americans into a war that they had no enthusiasm for. So, and he was a president who was very aware of public opinion. But on the other hand, he was anti-Nazi and he wanted to help the Allies against the Nazis. So he walked that tightrope until the moment when the Japanese attacked and America was drawn into the war willy-nilly.
Also, you're looking at Truman, a president who is often thought of as not being up to the job, as being very strong and very decisive.
Yes. Certainly, when Truman became president, a lot of people were worried, because until that moment, he hadn't shown qualities of great statesmanship. But the interesting thing about him is the way he rose to the occasion and grew into the job and did, in fact, become, in many ways, a very good president.
You start off the book focusing on the short period of days when Hitler came to absolute power. And it's a very powerful opening. And do you think that many of us are vague? We know about Hitler, but vague on how he actually came to control Germany.
Yes, and I wanted to deal with that episode in great detail, and that's why Winter of the World opens in Berlin in 1933, because people say Germany was a cultured country, a civilized country, a country that gave us Beethoven and Bach. And how could the German people let somebody like Hitler come to power? And so I wanted to begin by answering that question and showing how, with a mixture of cunning and brutality, he overcame the opposition and came to power. It's a piece of history that people are quite curious about. Actually, quite a lot of Germans don't know the details of that. You know, young Germans often don't know exactly how that happened and wonder, you know, how their grandparents' generation allowed that to happen. And the answer is that it was, you know, it wasn't some sort of cataclysm. It was a case of a leader, Hitler, and a party, the Nazis, who were very determined and completely ruthless and quite wily. And democratic people not being tough enough and quick enough off the mark to stop them.
I was struck by seeing a webpage that had the new book on it and the covers for all the different editions across the world. And it is fascinating because you realize that this is a story that will be read in Russia. It's a story that will be read in Germany. It's a story that will be read where these families have roots, as they do, of course, in the United States. And has that, I assume that was the idea all along, and something that you were enjoying in seeing how our united world comes together in reading the story.
Yes, and it's also something that I've learned more about. Of course, I was looking for international connections from a literary point of view because I wanted my characters to interact. And it was surprising how easy it was to make that happen in the story, simply because there were all those international connections. We migrated across the world. We crossed the world to fight in wars. And we crossed the world because we fell in love and got married. And it is, I think, the Century Trilogy shows the great extent to which people in different countries are interrelated, and how actions taken in Berlin or London affect the everyday lives of people in St. Petersburg and in Buffalo and in Paris. That's what the world is like. So we sometimes talk about globalization as if it had just been invented. It's like a very recent thing. But actually, it's not. The 20th century is a global century.
You write about Stalin and Hitler, of course, and they come across as ruthless, but also as not very smart.
Isn't that interesting? If you look at some of the decisions that they made, for example, in December 1941, Adolf Hitler declared war on the United States. The dumbest thing imaginable. What an idiot. Stalin told the Red Army that Hitler would not invade Russia. And so when Hitler did invade Russia in June 1941, some of the frontline troops of the Red Army didn't actually have any ammunition for their guns. Amazing blunders in an average leader. These would be terrible blunders. In two such leaders who had such a cataclysmic influence over the 20th century, I found it astonishing. I began thinking, okay, these guys were cruel. They were murderers, but they must have been smart to get where they were. And at the end of it, I realized they're not very smart at all.
As an Irishman, I guess it's genetic, but we're always taught that never let the details get in the way of a good story. For you as a historical novelist, is there ever a moment where you think, if that just wasn't there, this would be so much more fun at that moment?
It happens a lot, and it's usually to do with dates. I think of a great way to tell what happened in, let's say, 1942, and then I find that because of the exact dates of various battles, my characters can't be in the right place at the right time, and that's frustrating. And yes, that's when I think, wouldn't it be great if I could just alter the date of that battle so that it happens 3 months earlier? But I never do. I never do. I made a decision a long time ago that I would never violate history. I can add things to history. So if there's a meeting between two real people, I can put in a fictional character who's there at the meeting in the background and who's part of the conversations. I can add something, but I could never move the date of the meeting.
The name of the new book is Winter of the World. It is the second volume in the Century Trilogy. It is published by Dutton. Ken Follett, a great pleasure. Thank you so much for being with us.
It was a pleasure to be on the show. Thank you.
We enjoy hearing from our listeners about the show. You can email us at book@wamc.org and can listen again to this or find past book shows at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.
Tell me something, give me hope for the night. We don't know how we feel. We're just praying that we're doing this right, though that's not the way it seems. Summer gone, now winter's on its way. I will miss the days we had, the days we had.